Thanks for staying around, and thanks to the organizers, because I think this is an outstanding program, and it has been a very interesting conference. I've been here for 6 weeks. I'm about to leave. I wish I could stay. It has been very stimulating to me. I'm somewhat of a peripheral worker in terms of exoplanets. I work on lots of different things. I've occasionally worked on exoplanets, but I have found this very interesting, exciting, and of course, this is an enormously exciting area, an explosion of data, and the field is, of course, driven by data. There have also been a great many theoretical calculations that have been done. Sometimes people are reinventing the wheel. Sometimes they're trying to fit a Volkswagen Beetle wheel onto an SUV. But just like the dot-com bubble, it will all play out, and hopefully the good stuff will survive. Of course, the idea that stars are surrounded by planets is a very old one, and this is a delightful figure from an encyclopedia that was published in 1794, showing many different planetary systems, some of which might not be possible, they may not be stable. But this is on the cover of Physics Today back in April 2004, and it was a special issue devoted to planetary diversity, and this is a topic that I have thought quite a bit about, because I think, in fact, planets are extraordinarily diverse, and they will resist being simplified down to a low-dimensional space of understanding the way that astronomers have used the HR diagram. That will not work. Of course, there are many other ideas about planets elsewhere. This particular one is not particularly imaginative because it's remarkably Earth-like, and therefore, I suspect, improbable. So what are we trying to do? Basically, what we're trying to do is to characterize what's out there, probabilities of various architectures, range of behaviors, range of environments, and of course, in the longer term, beyond the collection of butterflies, if you will, we're trying to use this to improve our understanding of how planets form and evolve. And as a small part of that, we want to place our solar system in context. It may turn out, as people have suggested, that our solar system may not be typical, but of course, that's an interesting result. Something that hasn't come up much this week, and I'm glad it didn't, is the issue of habitability. I actually think this is an intellectually suspect goal. I've felt this for a long time. I think it's ill-defined. The usual notion of a habitable zone, in my opinion, is false. It's just simply not correct to think about the habitable zone the way many people do. But even if you try and define it better, it's probably unreachable anyway in terms of the observations that we can think about in the near term, certainly. And I'm not picking on exoplanets when I make this point, because I think the same is true for Mars and Europa. But of course, the public love it, and the public are paying. So I suppose we have to occasionally mention this word, especially when we get money from NASA. Now, there are two main communities that are participating in this exciting business, and one of them is astronomy and astrophysics, and the other is planetary science. And when I say planetary science, I am, of course, also including Earth science, because Earth is a planet. And it's interesting to think about the philosophies that underlie the two fields, for indeed they are different. And I can say this with confidence because I've worked a bit in the astronomy side and have a background in terms of where I was as a student, who I worked with when I was at Cornell as a student. So I have a sense of what this community is like. In astronomy, what we're getting in the case of the exoplanet business is, of course, the astonishing capability that they provide us in observational techniques, continually evolving and improving, and including things that we haven't heard about here this week. For example, radio astronomy, I will get back to that. And of course, in the history of astronomy, because they look at such a huge number of things, they naturally categorize. In that sense, they're behaving a little bit like biologists who categorize living organisms in terms of species. And there's a huge range of physical phenomena of importance when you think about the universe. And for any parameter that you think of, like pressure, temperature, energy scale, whatever, it's a very huge range. However, it is also true that in most of astronomy and astrophysics, the materials that they talk about and try to understand are simple. The center of the sun is quite simple. White dwarfs, even though they're degenerate matter, are actually very simple. Planets are not. So that brings me then to the way planetary science works. Of course, planetary science grew out of the Cold War. It may not have developed at all in the way we now see it with its emphasis on missions were it not for the competition with the Soviet Union. But there is more emphasis on the individuality of bodies, and in part that's just natural when you're dealing with a system that only has a few objects that you can visit. But in fact, the individuality is, I would argue, the central message of planetary exploration. It is the central thing we have understood about our solar system, that planets are individuals, and trying to categorize them is, to a large extent, a mistake. Even with planets that you think are similar, like Jupiter and Saturn, or Earth and Venus, the differences are striking and are important and are essential. So the resistance to generalization and reductionism, I would argue, is good. And I'm making this point because, of course, there will be a natural tendency, there is a natural tendency in the exoplanet business to use reductionism, and by all means try, but I predict you will fail. So in planetary science, and that includes the Earth, of course, we're dealing with complex materials and we're dealing with complex systems. There are, of course, complex systems in the rest of the universe, but the particular nature of the complexity is something that planetary scientists have learned to work with, and Earth scientists even more so. The Earth is a very complex system. Now, of course, there are aspects of what we do where there is crosstalk, and it's good. So in general, people who do spectroscopy applied to stars can talk to people who do spectroscopy and apply it to planets, although, of course, often with planets, you're dealing with more complicated molecules. In the case of astronomy, you're often dealing with atoms. But still, there's a lot of common ground there. And of course, there's a lot of common ground in dynamics, and that's true of the way the community is constructed. If you look around the country, the people who do planetary dynamics, some of them are in astronomy departments, some are in planetary science departments, and that's fine. Cosmic chemistry is another example of where there's a strong bridge between these two things. There are other areas such as high pressure physics where you can see the connection more directly with planetary science. That doesn't mean that there's no high pressure situations over in astrophysics and stars and so forth. It just means that in the case of applying it in astrophysics, the materials are simple. I think that the planetary perspective is going to be essential to the development of the field. And there will be an evolution. At the moment, it's the left-hand side of the diagram that's most important in exoplanets because they provide the data, and the data drives the field. So of course that will be true. But when it comes to really figuring out what's going on, I think the right-hand side of this diagram will be increasingly important. And of course there will be emerging, and the students who come out with PhDs in the coming decade or so will in many cases not wish to be card-carrying on either side. So it's useful to think about why planets might be diverse, and I've made 3 points here. First of all, there is a strong constraint on what a planet can be, and that comes from the requirement of stability. That is, a planet has to be close to hydrostatic equilibrium, but there's also a longer time scale stability that you have to think about. And then there's a cosmochemical constraint, and I will come back and say a few more words about this, but of course we do need to think about cosmic abundances. When I teach about planetary structure at Caltech, I like to tell students in the very first lecture that if it were only the need to satisfy the geophysical data, Earth's core could be made of niobium, a niobium alloy. But of course, from a cosmochemical point of view, that's ridiculous. The reason why we know the Earth's core is iron is because of chemistry, not because of physics. So it's a moderate constraint, but a very important one. And then there are weak constraints, and those have to do with formation scenarios. Now, I have a very high regard for people who construct formation models of planets and planetary systems, but in practice, theorists are very good at explaining any observation, even when it's wrong, and so in that sense, we need to be humble when we think about the extent to which we can use our formation narratives to constrain what could happen with planets. So what do all or nearly all planets have in common? Of course, there will be oddballs. The first planets discovered, of course, outside our solar system were around a pulsar. Those were oddballs. We're certainly going to use the same periodic table, not necessarily the same radioactivity and not necessarily the same ratios of elements. There's been a lot of talk about that at this meeting and earlier. And of course, we believe that the physics that works locally works elsewhere, and that we use the same rules that describe chemistry. What about a broadly common genesis story? I think most people subscribe to this, but I think you have to add a little bit of a question mark here. Interesting question there about whether we can be sure that there's only one story. But certainly the standard story involves gravitational collapse, a disk because of the angular momentum budget, and then the accretion of solids, that is the aggregation of solid condensed material, followed at least sometimes by the accretion of gas. But even with all of those consensus views, one then has the reality that we see in our solar system, and I expect will be true elsewhere, that planets of a similar mass and composition will have different behaviors. To be sure, the distance from the star plays a role, but not necessarily dominant. For example, I can conjure up a story where a planet like Venus, with its dense atmosphere and hot surface, could exist at 1 AU. And I can also dream up a story where a planet like Earth, with an ocean, habitable, dare I say it, at the position of Venus. It simply isn't true that the distance from the star is such a simple control parameter on environment. But certainly the environment of formation plays a role, the role of water, the role of other volatiles, and we've heard a lot, and I will come back to the question of hydrogen. But importantly, as I've already stressed, planets, unlike stars, are made of thermodynamically complex materials. They have complex melting behavior, which leads to volcanism. You know, the reason why the Earth has volcanism is because of the complexity of the mineralogy of the Earth's mantle. If you made the Earth's mantle pure olivine, you wouldn't have volcanoes. The effect of alloying, sulfur and iron, there are many other examples. But this, as a control parameter, can take you from a state where you can run a dynamo to a state where you can't, and it can change the size of the core and so forth. The effect of water on rock rheology, this is not a complete list. But then, of course, there's the role of chance, and it's entirely possible that many of the differences between Earth and Venus are the consequence of chance, that it's not deterministic, it's not related in some simple way to distance from the sun. The fact that Earth had a late giant impact that led to the moon and Venus did not, those are things that are elements of chance that can greatly change the outcome and the character of the body. And of course, whether or not you have life, which we don't understand, but we know at least that life has had a profound effect on Earth. It's not just that the environment on Earth allowed life to happen, but that life on Earth actually changed the environment, not just oxygen, in many different ways. Now, I want to turn to something that has been discussed a lot at this meeting, which is radius mass diagrams, radius as a function of mass. And I thought I would show you here the classic paper, the original paper. So this is Sapolsky and Saltpeter from 1969. This is a calculation based on Thomas Fermi Dirac theory. It actually does pretty damn well, probably better than you would expect it to. And of course, it's based on elements, but the way Thomas Fermi Dirac works, you can figure out the density of MgSiO3 just by taking the specific volume of magnesium and adding the specific volume of silicon and three times the specific volume of oxygen. And so you can get a pretty good idea of how the materials behave on such a diagram. The right-hand side of the diagram was, of course, worked out by Chandrasekhar, and that's relevant to white dwarfs. But they were the first people to do the left-hand side of the diagram, the planetary side. I worked on this myself a few years later, and I wanted to show you this diagram, which I published in 82, to make a point. Here we have the as solid lines, the cold curves for radius as a function of mass, but also the dashed lines, which are isentropes. And of course, because under planetary conditions, hydrogen and helium are supercritical in the thermodynamic sense, you get a huge difference depending on whether you're on an isentrope or whether you're on a cold isotherm. Notice, however, when I look back at this, that ice on an isentrope is beginning to deviate away from the cold line, and that's really true. Now, of course, the extent to which this happens is restricted by the fact that H2O has a molecular weight that's only nine times that of H2, and that makes a difference. But indeed, one has to worry a little, think a little about the role of temperature. Now, of course, at this conference, we've had many versions of this diagram. And I'm not choosing this one because it's especially better than others. I just use it as an example. And what is striking in this diagram is that there are many objects that are larger radius for a given mass than you might have expected for any of these theoretical curves. I would argue, by the way, that the theoretical curve for water is potentially misleading when you get down to small masses for precisely the reason I just mentioned, that you have to think about isentropes and maybe even higher temperatures. And I will come back to that in respect of magma oceans. But certainly, the thing that is most striking here is the existence of these large radius objects for a given mass. Dave Charbonneau, right at the beginning of the meeting, made the point that there is a subset of bodies that seem to sit on a single curve down in here. It's not so obvious in this particular diagram. It might be true, and if so, it's interesting. But perhaps the most striking thing that emerges from radius as a function of mass is the clear evidence for hydrogen-rich envelopes, even at some quite low-mass bodies. And of course, this is relevant to understanding how these bodies came to be formed, and we've heard quite a bit about this at the meeting. It's possible that there are water worlds, but it's not evident yet in the data. Perhaps there's a bias in the data because the data in the Kepler sample, at least, is concentrated towards smaller radial distance, although it could also be that a lot of systems have that as a characteristic. Perhaps because of migration. And indeed, some bodies could be Earth-like in composition, and maybe that's what we're going to be stuck with for the next several years in terms of analyzing this. But it is a fact, of course, that small differences in radius as a function of mass hide important differences in the nature of the body. And you'll see that in a moment. I'll talk about that a little bit more. But I wanted to make another point, and that is, please don't think that a body that had a hydrogen atmosphere, and then the hydrogen atmosphere was stripped away, will leave behind something that's Earth-like. That's not necessarily true, because you must not think of the atmosphere that was captured as being isolated from the interior. That's a false notion. The inside of the planet knows about the atmosphere, and the atmosphere knows about the inside. They communicate, and they communicate because the temperatures will be high enough when you're at several Earth masses that you will have magma oceans, you will not have solids, and there will be a lot of interplay chemically between those reservoirs. It's interesting that the most detailed early work on this question of Earth-like planets with atmospheres was done by a group run by the great Japanese astrophysicist Hayashi. He started this work in the mid-70s, and his group published a great many papers based on an idea that we now dismiss, namely that the Earth itself had a large hydrogen atmosphere. But it's great work, and I recommend you go look at it if you haven't looked at it before. It doesn't have to be this particular paper. There's a nice chapter about this work in Protostars and Planets, Volume 2. But indeed, they were talking about large hydrogen atmospheres, and they talked about the way in which they would escape, and they developed a very nice model for the rate at which the gas escapes. And they were able to convince themselves that indeed the Earth could lose such an atmosphere using the far UV from the early sun. Of course, if you were to make a planet like this and then eject it from the solar system, you might still have that atmosphere, and then you would have an interstellar planet, and there may indeed be objects like this with dense hydrogen atmospheres. They become thinner, of course, as they cool off, but they are beautiful insulators of the interior of the body, so that you can even have an ocean in interstellar space. Hydrogen is a good greenhouse gas because of pressure-induced opacity. So what then about the role of high-pressure physics? We've had several talks here at this meeting about high-pressure physics. I don't think there's any realistic likelihood that there will be any major surprises that change the radius-mass relationship from high-pressure physics. There may be some important issues that arise because of high temperatures, because some of these bodies can have 10,000 Kelvin temperatures inside, or more if we're going up to a few Earth masses. And in fact, it's generally good enough already to use generic equations of state. Radius-mass diagrams will have slight modifications in the slope of the R versus M curve as you go through phase transitions and fiddle around with the composition, but those are details down at the level that are unlikely to be detectable in any conceivable future data set. But there are some very important and interesting issues that have to do with the mixing of the materials, the interplay of the materials that go into the body, and of course, whether you have liquid or solid, and whether you have cores. Super-Earths need not have iron-rich cores, because the existence of a core depends actually on two things. It depends on the details of the chemistry, for example, oxidation state, but also importantly on miscibility, whether the material that wants to form a metallic alloy does or does not mix with the silicate component. And there has to be, from fundamental thermodynamics, there has to be a temperature above which the materials will mix in all proportions. So I think super-Earths may not have cores in the sense of the way the word core is used in Earth science, meaning an iron core. This may not affect the radius versus mass, of course. It's been known for a long, long time that if you take any planet and undifferentiate it so that everything's mixed up, you don't change the radius significantly. That's true for the Earth, by the way. The central pressure of the Earth, which is at about 360 GPa, does actually get a little bit smaller if you were to take a hypothetical Earth where you went in with a spoon and just mixed everything up. And that's generally true. You see that, by the way, if you go to the classic textbook by Chandrasekhar, where he actually talks about pressure variation within stars. If you put a more dense region close to the planet, the pressure goes up. You can prove that rigorously. And therefore, the density, mean density, changes a little bit. But of course, to the extent that materials mix, it affects the chemistry of the system, and it affects what is left behind, and it will affect outgassing and so forth. And the current thinking on this is quite primitive. In general, thinking about chemistry is important. At low pressures, of course, we're familiar with the idea that if you've got water and you have a polar material, then it will dissolve. When you go to high pressure, things get more complicated, but the same general concern applies, that you have to think about whether the materials are going to mix. What about the role of cosmo and geochemistry? I think it's important. Two main issues, there are others. The ones I want to mention, and they've come up, of course, in the program here, are relative elemental abundances. Of course, people often talk about metallicity. Yes, I understand that. Metallicity is important, but the relative abundances matter as well. Magnesium to silicon ratio matters a lot. Iron to magnesium matters a lot, affecting the minerals that form, and of course the oxidation state. And the interesting thing about the oxidation state is that, at least in part, this is a statement about what happened when the bodies first accreted, the planetesimals. And actually, this is imperfectly understood. We don't really understand exactly how this is set in our own solar system. The carrier of oxygen, of course, the main carrier of oxygen is water, so you have to think about the water partial pressure when you think about which minerals are formed. But you could, for example, think about systems, there may be systems out there where there's no metallic iron at all, where the iron is entirely oxidized. It's interesting that in the context of our solar system, Ted Ringwood, long, long ago, actually published a paper where he suggested that that Mars is so oxidized that there's no metallic iron core. That turns out to be untrue, but the point is it was not a ridiculous idea. And certainly any statement about metallic core sizes is hugely variable and depends on many parameters. What about the role of atmospheres? Now, I've said that radius is a function of mass. It's going to be hard to make a lot of progress on using that measurement, even though I think it's a vital measurement, and I'm hoping that there will be a lot more data points on that plot as the years go by. But still, we want something else, and the something else is surely going to be the atmosphere, and I think this is important, because the atmosphere should never be thought of as something you add on top. Should never think about an atmosphere that way. Even when it's accreted from the nebula, you should not think of it that way. So when you think about these planets that supposedly have cores, I'm now using core in the sense most people here have been using it to mean all the solid part and then you put gas on top. You shouldn't think of those as isolated entities. They interact and they can interact in a major way, and a substantial part of what you're putting in the atmosphere can end up inside. So that means, of course, that the distinction between accreted and outgassed is somewhat artificial. And I think actually this terminology is incorrect. One should not think of outgassed and accreted gas as distinct things. They overlap in meaning and in context, and so we may need to come up with a better way of semantics in this case. But anyway, it's clear that the outgassed can be accreted in more than one way. People often think about outgassed in the sense we talk about water on the Earth, where water is actually in the rocky material that goes into the planet, and then you heat up that rock and you make magma, and the water goes into the magma, the magma comes to the surface, gets pressure released, water molecules come out as steam. Yes, that's outgassing, but there are other ways to do outgassing. So atmospheres are potentially diagnostic of the interior, I think, but this requires more work. Potentially diagnostic because to the extent that the materials mix and to the extent that you can mix in hydrogen, for example, that changes the chemistry And so it changes what's in the atmosphere. So you can look at the atmosphere to learn about the interior, which, by the way, is what we do in our solar system. And it's what we do when we look at Jupiter to try and figure out what's happening inside of Jupiter. Admittedly, with noble gases, which you're not going to do for exoplanets. But the principle applies. That is, there is a kind of petrology for atmospheres whereby you look at the atmosphere and figure out what's inside. You can also look at the atmosphere to answer the question, is there a solid surface below the atmosphere you're looking at? It's a very interesting question, one that people struggled over in the case of Titan, because in the early observations of Titan, Gerard Kuiper was looking at methane, classic work in the early history of planetary science. The question arose, where the hell's the surface? You couldn't tell. It was eventually determined by occultation, but you could ask whether the specifics of the molecules in the atmosphere might tell you something about that. Now, I want to turn finally to a little bit about where we're going and the kinds of measurements that can be made and so forth. And so I'm putting in this diagram to remind you all that in terms of masses that you can detect as a function of orbital radii, for example, there are a number of different techniques, and they tend to favor a particular range in periods and sometimes mass. And some of these are kind of interesting as examples of things that we would like to know more about, but there aren't many of them. For example, microlensing. Let's hope that microlensing becomes more important. You'll notice there aren't very many points here, but of course microlensing has this beautiful property through Einstein's equations that you have sensitivity to low masses so that you can detect things that are down at Earth mass and out at large radii, albeit it's like looking for a needle in a haystack, but it can be done with small telescopes, and there are of course people doing this, and so let's hope that this and the other techniques take off. And of course direct imaging is also of great importance, and it's going to become more important, albeit at least initially, for giant planets. So what are the other kinds of measurements that you could imagine doing? Time variability in general, that is, looking at a system and looking for time variation in the context of the kind of data that Heather Knudsen gets with secondary eclipses, secondary with transit data and so forth. Be great to get rotation. There are many reasons why it would be interesting to get rotation, and of course obliquity. This is hard, but we shouldn't give up because it's a very important dynamical variable. People might dismiss it by saying, well, if I'm close in, I'm tidally locked. It's not clear that's true. Jeremy LeConte has this very nice work on thermal tides showing that in some cases that may not be true. So you learn something about these bodies. And of course, further out, you learn quite a bit. And you can place constraints on your origin stories by thinking about what the origin of the rotation is, whether you're doing it with giant impacts or gas inflow or whatever. So it's diagnostic. And of course, satellites and rings. Let's hope that somebody finds moons around exoplanets. Again, I realize this is really hard. And of course, the planets that are close in are unlikely to have moons. In many cases, that's not a stable situation. But this is fascinating in terms of origin, and also, of course, can tell us, as it has in our solar system, something about internal structure. It can tell us about the J2, the component of the gravity field of the planet that comes from its own rotation. So if you know the rotation in J2, you can get the moment of inertia. Likewise, in a very similar way, the Love numbers that describe the response of the body. In some cases, that can be tidal, but it's basically the same information as what's in the rotational response. Rings, of course, again, of great interest. There's even one claimed example, at least, of this in the literature for stars elsewhere. And of course, for disks, there's a lot of information, the early history of disks, about systems that might or might not have formed rings, in that case, around the star. What about magnetic fields? We've talked about magnetic fields. Here we're talking about radio observations. My colleague at Caltech, Reg Hallinen, is hot on this and thinks it can be done. It might require going into space if you want to get small fields, because of course the Earth's ionosphere cuts off the decametric radiation from the magnetosphere of a planet when you are at small field strengths of order of Gauss. When you get to larger fields, you can have the signal get through, but there could well be planets out there that are at several Gauss or more, so that you can even do some of this stuff from the ground. The problem, of course, is that magnetic fields, that is, dynamos, have not been that diagnostic or predictable in our own solar system. But I think there is still interesting information there. You've heard earlier today opinions about that from Bruce Buffett and from Gary and Jonathan. We can always hope that you can do this. And of course, by the way, if you can do it, you also get rotation, because of course, if you have obliquity, you have a signal that tells you rotation. That's how we know the rotation of Jupiter so exactly. And of course, it can have other consequences in magnetic, in atmospheric loss and so forth. One comment I would make about this in general is that people often fixate. I've noticed this time and again. People have the tendency, when they think about super Earths, to think about scaling up the Earth. And so they say, oh, Earth has a dynamo in the core, therefore when I go to a bigger planet, I have to think about a dynamo in the core of that planet. I think that's wrong. If that planet has an atmosphere, and many of them, as you saw, do, then they have very hot magma oceans, and hot magma oceans can support dynamos. So you can do it without metallic iron, which, by the way, is sort of on the connection line between super-Earths and Uranus and Neptune. Uranus and Neptune seem to have rather little difficulty in generating magnetic fields. We think terrestrial planets have difficulty. And of course, there are many kinds of physical modeling that you can imagine doing: atmospheric dynamics, coupling with clouds, photochemistry, atmospheric escape. We've heard several presentations here about atmospheric escape. There's a fudge parameter in that, which Jonathan Fortney assures me is close to 0.1. I don't know. It's an interesting question. What happens to water? Role of hot magma oceans? Another dimensionless number that I regard as somewhat infamous is the tidal Q. That's an interesting parameter in the evolution of these systems. Just like this parameter, it hides our ignorance. That's what I mean by infamous. These are things that we would like to understand better. We do not understand Q. So what about the opportunities ahead? Well, actually, I'm encouraged, more so than before I got involved in this program. I can see that there's going to be a lot going on. JWST will be oversubscribed, but with Tess and with others, I haven't listed everything here, I can see that this is going to be an exciting field in the coming decade. It's not clear beyond that, but certainly in the coming decade. And of course, there's microlensing, direct imaging, which I think will be important, although perhaps not so much for the objects of focus at this meeting, more so for the Jupiters, which are less common. And let's hope we can do radio. And of course, there's the ongoing work that's been going on for decades of characterizing the disks from which planets form. Now, Robert Frost, of course, got us thinking about alternatives, alternative directions, and you should too. Is there something that's missing? Is there some other road less traveled that one could go along that you could do things for? And let's hope that there are some and that people should think about it. But there's another philosopher, Jerry Seinfeld, who reminds us that sometimes the road less traveled is less traveled for a reason. And so you need to think about the fact that we have finite resources and you have to make choices. Okay, last slide, almost. A comment about how science works. And I say this from my personal experience and also from reading the history of science. In a new field especially, the trend is to develop a sense that you're understanding what's going on fairly quickly, to begin with as the data accumulate. But then very often the curve turns over. You can think of this as time or as accumulation of data. Usually that's monotonic, although sometimes people come along a year later and say, oops, that data was false. But still, this is roughly time in that direction. But the claimed understanding is non-monotonic. That is, you can come to a point, turnover point, where you suddenly realize, it could even be a phase transition, you suddenly realize that what you thought you understood, you actually don't understand at all. So that's a warning, because I think this is actually the usual pattern of science. And so be prepared to be disappointed and be patient. And that is it. I will finish with a suggestion about future vacations. Thank you.
Very interesting talk, Dave. Your comments on the complexity of bodies, and the big bodies being relative stars and things being simpler in many aspects, led me to think about, well, rocks are also fairly simple unless they're agglomerates of lots of little things. And then what's the most complex thing? What's the most complex size? I gravitated towards Earth, but I think that's from lack of knowledge, because we know processes that develop as you get bigger to Earth, and then we don't know what happens beyond Earth.
So this is actually a very interesting question. The one way to think about it is that when you go to very high pressures, and therefore very high masses, you are increasingly going to the Fermi gas limit. And indeed, that's sort of true. But it's also true, and this is something that has been surprising to many people in recent years, that when you look at materials that you might think upon compression will go from being an insulator to a metal, can sometimes go to a metal and then go back to an insulator, or in some cases you can start with a metal and make an insulator. That's true for sodium, which when I was a student was put up there on a pedestal as the classic simple metal. Sodium, classic simple metal. Alkali metal, turns out when you squeeze sodium, it actually becomes an insulator. I think these things are actually a little bit less important in planets just because the temperatures are also high. But to get back to your question, it is sort of Earth mass. And when you get, for example, into the deep interior of Jupiter, in some sense, things are simpler. We think that at 10 megabars, 20, 30, 40, things are a little bit simpler, at least for hydrogen. It's not so clear. It's not so obvious, actually, for the rocky component. But in a certain sense, it may get simpler. So in that sense, Earth mass or a few Earth masses, it's complicated.
Dave?
I share your interest and desire to learn from atmospheres about the interior. And I don't want to be negative, but at the same time, I recognize that, particularly for the planet Earth, the way we started out and the way we ended up is very, very different in our atmospheric composition.
Yep. So something that I could have explicitly listed, but it's always implicit, is the role of time. That is, any way we seek to characterize planets, we have to think about time as well. And so you could look at a planet when it's a billion years old and look at it when it's 4 billion and see something different. You know, people debate whether Venus had a dense CO2 atmosphere from the outset. We don't actually know. And we don't have a way of deciding that question. So sure, you can have big changes with time.
So you suggested the distinction between the accreted and outgassed the concept. I sort of, to the broad sense, I accepted that if it is accreted, it will be most likely hydrogen and helium, and if it is the gassed, it might be water-rich and CO2-rich. Is that sort of broad so distinction not helpful, or?
That's the way people usually think about it.
Yeah.
I think it's wrong. For example, if you accrete an Earth mass and you've got a hydrogen atmosphere on top that's in hydrostatic equilibrium with the nebula, the basal temperature of that atmosphere is several thousand degrees typically. Depends a bit on parameters, but often it's several thousand degrees. Rock evaporates in that situation. At low pressure, at high pressure, of course, it'll be supercritical. So the point is that the sharp distinctions that we normally make break down. Now, I don't know for sure, since hydrogen is less dense, of course, I don't know for sure the outcome. But I have an instinct based on experience in planetary science that tells me that you must not put too much weight on what is light and what is heavy. Because that doesn't help in understanding planets. It really doesn't. It tells you where things finally go if they unmix. But if things mix, it's not helpful to say that something is less dense than something else, because chemistry wins. I'm sure Bill will like that statement. Chemistry wins. I mean, gravity wins. So, you know, so if I have water and oil and I make an emulsion, they won't separate. Actually, the minerals in the Earth's mantle have different density. They don't separate, although that's because of high viscosity. But, you know, if there were any uranium in the core, it doesn't go to the center of the Earth. So you have to think about the chemistry. Uranium, of course, is mostly near the Earth's surface. So you have to think about chemistry. And yes, you apply gravity when it's appropriate to do so, but don't apply gravity without having first thought through the chemistry.
A comment about complexity as well as Jack had. I'm old enough that I've seen the landing of Apollo 11 on the moon and lived through this fantastic period of space exploration. And I agree with you that every space mission was showing us images of planets or bodies that we would not even have thought they looked the way they did. I mean, in terms of their tectonics or surface expression and all that. So this is true that there was this incredible diversity and complexity of these things in the solar system. But at the same time, the impression I have is that they are all doing the same job, basically. That is, these planets we are looking at are basically some giant thermal, mechanical, chemical machines. They have some energy to get rid of, basically, and they convect, and they have some exchanges between the different envelopes and so on. So there is some basic simplicity in some way. It's all these things are also demonstrating very nicely that they're trying to get their energy out in very imaginative ways, but still doing the same thing. And in some sense, maybe a comparison can be made with turbulence. Turbulence is also very complex. You see lots of structures and stuff and so on. But at the same time, its role is very dumb. It's just to get from the large scale to the small scale where you can dissipate, and that's all they're doing. So I'm wondering if we can look for the simplicity behind the mechanisms which are producing this very large diversity and complexity.
So I believe in the first law and second laws of thermodynamics. And of course, you can do things with that. But there are lots of things you can't do. For example, you can't on that basis alone assess the question of whether energy that is put into a planet during accretion actually gets out. People usually assume it does, but the reason why they're assuming that is because they think they make a homogeneous layer. But if I set up a compositional layer, the heat doesn't even get out. And so I see a lot of additional degrees of freedom that people have suppressed from their thinking because their thinking came from thinking about the Earth or from thinking about planets in our solar system. I think there's a richness of behavior that we've only partially appreciated, even within our own solar system. And so we're going to see. Now, of course, you know, my training is as a physicist, and so I understand the value, when it's applied carefully, of reductionism, of looking for simplicity. But I also fear the use of simplicity to hide the underlying more complicated behavior, because that can lead to a misunderstanding and lead to false predictions. But sure, I mean, you know, if you can find simplifications, if you can, I mean, if somebody Somebody comes along with the planetary equivalent of the HR diagram, it'll probably have 27 dimensions. But anyway, if you can do it, then do it.
I'd like to follow that up briefly from an astronomical perspective. There won't be an HR diagram for planets, but if you look at the processes that were in your talk, most, not all, but most of them are really beyond the level of the current data.
Yes.
So if you're thinking about planetary system architectures at the level that the data exists today, you're not going to need to model every one of those 4,000 systems separately. And in fact, we already know that because you see patterns in the data already. So I would argue that the current data is at the level where it merits an astrophysical analysis. And the key point is to decide when that transition occurs to need to look at planets individually. And I don't think we're there yet.
You're making a good point, and I'm glad that you said that, because there's a lot of truth in what you said, that many of the things I'm talking about are at the next step, and there's a great deal to be learned at the current stage by getting more points just on the radius mass diagram and having a better understanding of the architecture of the different planetary systems and how planets are distributed with orbital radius and so forth. Yes, of course.
Actually, to follow up on this, as someone who's not quite in this on this topic, could you elaborate on what these future, near future missions are going, you know, are focused on improving in the big picture of things?
So there are many different things, and there are better people in the room to answer that. Is there somebody who wants to talk about TESS? You know, Jonathan Fortney talked about the importance of getting away from just looking at the transmission spectra, because that's a long path length through the atmosphere, and looking at emission spectra to get a better understanding of the atmosphere. But somebody want to give a brief description of, go ahead.
TESS is a all sky version of Kepler with very wide range of small lenses. And what it will do, it will not be staring as long. It does not have the same photometric sensitivity. So it won't get as good statistics on planets and planetary architectures. But it will find transiting planets that are much closer, around much brighter stars, and more amenable to follow up, both by radial velocity to get their masses for the mass-radius relationship, and other things that depend on stellar properties, but also observations by James Webb Space Telescope and ground-based telescopes to learn more about their atmospheres, and perhaps more capability of eventually discerning magnetic fields, etc.
Dave, didn't you publish a Physics Today article once with an HR diagram of planets in it?
What is the...
Well, with, it had a triangle for the various compositions.
Oh, yeah. I know the one you mean, yes. That's not an HR diagram. But you're right. Yes, I attempted to draw a diagram which is of the kind that geochemists and petrologists love to do, with rock at one vertex, ice and gas, and then I said, you know, all the planets in the solar system are points on that diagram, and there are trends, and yeah, so most of the planets in the universe could be put on that diagram.
Any further questions, comments? Well, if not, the hour is up. So let's thank Dave and all of our speakers today. I'm not going to say much. I always say thank you all for coming. I just want to say that the last long program, as far as I remember, was 6 years ago. So if you want to have another workshop like this, it's probably in 6 years, which is 2021. And it needs about 2 years of preparation. So if you think about the young people in the field, this is an opportunity. They're open in principle, even though it's an institute for theoretical physics, to have a workshop on exoplanets. So think about it in the long run. We probably have to propose this in 4 years or earlier. So thanks all for the great talks. Thank you so much. We'll see you hopefully in 6 years.